Anaxagoras 8. 4 June 1968. Howard is not yet back, so I'm reluctant to continue with observations of the multiples in any attempt to induce exomatic experience. But Alice was very insistent, saying she felt she needed to do it, for some reason she could not express. So I say reluctantly, we went to 3SSB. Griffin, who is also a grad student with our department, working with Dr. Rand, accompanied me, offering to provide the validation of observations that I should make and assist me with the equipment that we monitor. Alice, atypical to her inducement routine, said she would try the meditation technique that Griffin had been teaching her, something taken from Dr. Singh and his yogic practices. The instruments showed a very rapid descent, but a sustained alertness, a lingering in a theta state, that of childish, playful imagining. The episode lasted more than an hour. The flow of it assumed what is looking like a certain consistent pattern in the unusual readings that appear, utterly peculiar and distinctive from normal sleep and normal dreaming, and not at all like the brainwaves seen in lucid dreaming, which I have previously studied. Alice did not move from her supine position. There were no REM observed, no signature accelerated heartbeat, skin galvanization, etc. She was motionless and serene. She made no vocalizations. It was so peaceful an episode that I took to idly doodling. I drew fleur-de-lis on my notes, but resisted speaking to Griffin, who seemed fascinated with the measurement of the instruments. When Alice awoke, happily sitting up and smiling at us, she asked, "Did you see?" Griffin and I, looking at one another, agreed we had seen nothing. What did she mean? "I came out and stood beside you, both of you. I saw you working. I touched you, or I tried to. Both of you. Didn't you feel it?" "No," said Griffin. "What did you see precisely?" I asked. "I saw you drawing on your paper. You were drawing crosses." I sighed in some disappointment. This was like the common failures in ESP experiments, an approximate but vague perception of reality. She came out of the observation room and stood behind me, looking down at the desk and my notes. There, that's what I saw. "These?" I asked. "These are fleur-de-lis. I don't know what the name for them is, but that is what I saw. I only call them crosses because I did not know the name." 5 June, 1968. Rachel is still gone. She has not called. Zoe's a little worried, but Rachel has done this before. Sometimes absent for as much as a week. I told Zoe I was sure she would come back soon. What I wrote yesterday, what my ecstatic insight of the day before had taught me, when I addressed Griffin about the nature of time, is taken in part from Carl Jung and his essay, Synchronicity, only just published a few years ago in an English translation. While much of what he says regarding it seems dense, even muddled, I agree with the direction toward which he is heading. I do not think I should choose to use the word synchronicity or a causal connection, but I am gratified to see he sees the significance of ESP and exomatic experience, although here again I thought his discussion obtuse. And his notion that synchronicity should be read into data of astrological coincidence is unsavory to me. But who knows? I have not seriously evaluated the matter. At any rate, it is one particular footnote in his text that I found compelling. There you go. I wonder if my own footnotes are more salient than my text. It is this story about Monsieur de Champ. A certain Monsieur de Champ, when a boy in Orleans, was once given a piece of plum pudding by his neighbor, Monsieur de Fortegabu. 10 years later, he discovered another plum pudding in a Paris restaurant and asked if he could have another piece. It turned out, however, that the plum pudding had already been ordered by another customer, Monsieur de Fortegabu. Many years afterwards, at a private dinner, Monsieur de Champ was invited to partake of a plum pudding as a special rarity. While he was eating it, he remarked the only thing lacking was Monsieur de Fortegabu. And at that moment, the door opened, and an old man in the last stages of disorientation walked in, Monsieur de Fortegabu, who had got hold of a wrong address and burst in on this party by mistake. This seemed to me an excellent anecdote for its unlikelihood to represent the ideas that I have expressed, that time is conjoined in the way that one electron is in two places at once, that space and time are indeterminate, and that indeed a single event may occupy two or more moments. Hence, although this is only a philosophical and not a scientific explanation, a hypothesis perhaps, the fact that a consciousness can be in two places at once should not surprise, but reflects the nature of things. Of course, I remain mystified, because despite my own long-held belief in materialism, it appears that mind and body are separable, and that mind is something rather more than physical, as we understand physicality. I am hoping the research will elucidate this, or at least resolve my doubts and misgivings by evidence that I cannot deny. 6 June, 1968. Today is the California primary. Howard is taking the red eye from Los Angeles and shall be arriving at O'Hare early tomorrow morning. Griffin and Mock Turtle will take my car and pick him up at the terminal. Rachel returned late this afternoon while I was preparing dinner for the girls. I'm making curry. These girls have never tasted Indian curries, and because Griffin and White Rabbit are both vegetarians, this will be an eye-opener, being used to the bland, boiled American vegetables whose only flavor is salty water from the can. Saffron rice pilaf with pinon nuts and currants, a chole with cloves and cinnamon as well as the usual ginger, etc., one of my favorites. And then, for those of us with too little conscience toward our fellow sentient beings, a savory lamb curry. Yes, yes, I can hear Zoe enthusing. Rachel wants to talk, to tell what she's been doing. I can sense this. She's a vegetarian also, but for her it's a political statement, and eating salads is an act of ascetic protest against capitalist slaughterhouses. She makes up for it by eating donuts, which helps her keep her figure. She was north of here, she says, sitting on the kitchen stool as I mince onions and garlic. Zoe is hugging her legs, sitting on the floor looking up at her, glad she is home. At the meeting of the Yippie and the MOBE, Rachel explains, to plan the disruption of the Democratic National Convention when they come to Chicago in August. Jerry Rubin has asked me to lead the phalanx from the university. What is a yippie? If you don't know what it means, it's no use telling you. Sois jeune et tais-toi. What's that supposed to mean? If you don't know what it means, there's no use telling you. Zoe laughed. Rachel looked at me harshly. I might have apologized, but she laughed angrily. She turned on the TV and the stereo. Tears are running, ah, they're all running down your breast. And your friends, baby, they treat you like a guest. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love. Her song. Zoe apologized to me and went to talk to her. When I had finished dinner, I found that she and Rachel had gone to their room, the TV still on, the stereo loudly playing Grace Slick singing. When logic and proportion have fallen sloppy dead, and the white knight is talking backwards, and the red queen's off with her head, remember what the Dormouse said. Feed your head, feed your head, feed your head. I turned off the stereo. The CBS News previewed the California primary. They said it was too close to call. The polling data showed that McCarthy had gained on Kennedy. I turned off the TV. I called the girls to dinner. Rachel and Zoe did not come. They were all quite surprised and pleased with the curries. I remember the first curries that I had ever eaten. After I had come to Oxford, we, some of us students, took a train to Manchester, which I've never seen, and they have large Indian neighborhoods there where curry restaurants flourish, sustained by whites and coloreds both. And they still make the best curries in the world there in Manchester, which should otherwise be the home of soccer hooligans and mushy peas. After dinner, I read and worked on my notes until almost 1 a.m., hoping that the results of the primary would be announced. It was still undecided. I was going to turn off the TV and go to bed, but Rachel and Zoe came down, and so I offered to reheat the curries for them. Rachel said she was not hungry, and Zoe thanked me, but made herself a salad instead. She had not assumed Rachel's vegetarian habits, but usually avoided eating meat when she was in her presence, because Rachel would criticize her. Rachel sat with a gloomy stare on the TV while Zoe ate hungrily. I brought all of us some bottled beers from the refrigerator. Just before CBS was going to sign off, a little past 2 in the morning, Robert Kennedy came to the podium at his campaign headquarters and declared victory. "We want Kennedy! We want Kennedy!" the crowd chanted. The candidate, his wife standing beside him after struggling to get the audio corrected, thanked his supporters and his dog Freckles, who has been much maligned. Freckles has gone home to bed. He thought very early we would win tonight, so he went home and retired. I intend to keep the promises I have made during my campaign. We can work together. We are a great country and a selfless country and a compassionate country. What all of these primaries and all of these caucuses across the United States over the past several months, what these mean is that the people in the United States are wanting change. We want to deal with our own problems in our own country, and we want peace in Vietnam. So it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. "We want Bobby, we want Bobby," the crowd chanting. And the candidate leaves the room. CBS wrapped up quickly and signed off a prolonged broadcast. Band music of the Star Spangled Banner played over an image of a waving stars and stripes in a technical wind. Rachel grimaced at it. The monotone monoscope test pattern will show shortly. I said good night and went upstairs to bed. I was brushing my teeth when Zoe came knocking on the door and pushed it open. "He's been shot! He's been shot!" We ran downstairs. Rachel was standing before the TV, smiling, where coverage had suddenly resumed. I looked at its images in horror. "Is there a doctor? Is there a doctor?" someone was asking from the podium, where he had just been speaking. A camera is broadcasting live, jostled. All you can see are crowds looking the other way. Someone waves the camera away, a hand stretched out to prevent it from coming closer, from seeing him. The unseen commentator is distraught. Blood is on the floor. Blood on the floor. They're waving a fan on his face. His eyes are closed. Waving a fan on his face. Here comes the doctor. "Help, Bobby. Help, Bobby." Someone else's voice from afar. "Who did the shooting? Does anybody know?" The commentator continuing. More tussling in the crowd. The camera glimpses Kennedy sprawled in chiaroscura, a pathetic pieta, in the arms of a busboy on the cold concrete floor, and is pushed away. The senator is lying on the floor. Here is his wife, Mrs. Kennedy. They're asking us to turn the lights off. "Jesus Christ," another voice says as the camera is turned off. No image on the TV. A gray blankness. An awkward cut to an empty desk. A studio reporter is hastily summoned. He stutters to summarize what has been seen and what is known and what is being told to him off camera. Notes handed to him repeatedly. 8 shots were fired. Very rapidly. Almost like a machine gun, he said. Rachel said, "Good." I looked at her incredulously. Zoe was weeping on the sofa. I went to sit here, and I realized I was weeping uncontrollably, too. I felt myself in pain. 8 June, 1968. I could write nothing yesterday. With the summary of the day before, I cannot write much now. Howard had heard on the airplane. It was announced in flight by the pilot, another Kennedy dead. This surely looks like a conspiracy. First his brother, then King, and now he. We all feel quite hopeless. The campus is in mourning. Black crepe festoons our club walls. American flags are draped from the windows of those dormitories open in the summer. Pictures of Bobby bunted with black crepe are everywhere. In the restaurants, the dry cleaners, the bakery. On all channels, TV is broadcasting reprise, regrets, remorse, seamlessly, continuously. At the funeral broadcast on TV this morning, his brother said in a broken voice, his pitiful sorrow felt by all of us. "My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us and what he wished for others will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times, in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, 'Why?' I dream things that never were and say, 'Why not?' So we must go on. We must go on. But I do not know how we shall. What hope is there now? Zoe cannot get out of bed. Howard is sullen and silent. Rachel seems strangely stimulated by it. I am glad when she tells me she must go away for a few days. 12 June, 1968. None of us feel like working. but Howard and I met to design experiments and to establish a schedule for the subjects. Because Alice, Griffin, and Cheshire Cat have the greatest range in experience, and the greater facility to self-induce the experience, they shall be scheduled twice in the week, the others but once. It is not so much their capacities as the limitation of our labor. We must record and collate and catalog the data as we go after each observation. And even with the two of us, this may take considerable time. I have asked Dr. Rand if I may employ Griffin, who is technically his aide, although not employed by him this summer. He's reluctant. Actually, he refuses to reply. He says I must talk to the chair. The tentative schedule then has been worked out. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. In the morning, Griffin, Alice, White Rabbit, Caterpillar, Cheshire Cat. In the afternoon, no one on Monday, but then again, Mock Turtle, Cheshire Cat, Griffin, Alice. Two in a day. We shall also alternate the morning and afternoon assignments on any given day so that this variable is dismissed. We cannot commence the schedule until this Thursday because Howard must attend his physical by the Selective Service on Wednesday. It has come upon us fast. I hope really that they find something wrong with him. He says that some of his friends said that he should eat several Schweizer licorice bars before he goes in because it will elevate his blood pressure. He said he expected his blood pressure would be elevated anyway. He joked that perhaps he should put a Switzer licorice stick inside his anus, so when the sergeant shines a flashlight between his ass cheeks, he will guess he must be queer. Or odd, certainly. 29 June, 1968. Howard has known for some time that it would happen, but today he received the official notice by registered mail that he is 1A, fit for duty, and is directed to report for induction on July 15. He still does not know what he will do. I repeated my offer to assist his escape to Canada, should that be his decision. I do not want to give an opinion. This a life-changing moment, a decision he must make freely. Knowing that we have little time left under the circumstances, we have hastened our efforts to summarize the initial data and to commence experiment. The data is compellingly coherent. Subjects practice inducement in several ways as I have described, but all use some means to meditate and deeply relax. All are supine because of the bed we're given them, and because of the necessity that they lie still as our instruments measure their brain waves, GSR, pulse, breaths, and blood pressure. They have, Howard says, 27 electrodes streaming from their scalp and body to our machines. These, then, are technical limitations. The subjects have more or less accustomed themselves to the room, to a strange and uncomfortable array of electrodes and wires, and to the rigor of our measurements and the precision of our observation routine. Having grown more and more at ease, they are all now able to achieve some effective self-inducements. Some reported episodes of exomatic experience have had fairly long durations, the longest being perhaps a quarter hour, but most quite brief, a few minutes in the main. We have no way to determine this, and the subjects can only estimate what is a subjective perception. However, we have hypothesized a correlation of certain brain wave patterns and other consonant data with the exomatic experience, and these generally coincide with the perception of durations as reported. Although, as I say, the special awareness of time lagging by experience makes telling time unreliable. The subjects consistently reveal this pattern during successful events, reported exomatic experience. Stage 1. A lengthy period of theta waves, far longer than is seen in normal sleep, evidently a state which is normal to meditation, which was revealed in data taken by trials with Dr. Singh. Stage 2, typically a period of fluctuation between theta and delta, or even steady delta. Stage 3, where we might expect a pattern of REM dreaming in normal sleep, we get instead a profound burst of gamma, the mystery wave. It seems that during this gamma, that the flight out of body takes place. What is also remarkable is that there is no other signature REM readings. No elevated pulse, no elevated blood pressure, no rapid breathing, and no rapid eye movement. The body seems in the characteristic paralysis of REM, but exhibits none of the other physiological characteristics. Stage 4, typically the subject awakes, and a very high active amplitude pattern of beta begins, without any intervening theta or alpha, as in awaking from REM dreaming. Some variances to this pattern are, 1, sometimes in stage 1 the initial theta dominance is subsumed by or alternates with alpha wave patterns, as if the meditation is unfocused. Often then the subject fails to take flight and a normal sleep-dream pattern arises. 2, sometimes there is a brief normal REM dream pattern after the gamma, intervening between stage 3 and 4, but a rapid awakening then soon occurs. 3, during some stage 3 events, REM episodes will interrupt it, or we have also seen REM episodes that almost eclipse and mask very brief gamma bursts. During these, the subjects report an eczematic event, but express anxiety or difficulty concerning it. Of this data, then the singular discovery is the distinction from normal stages of sleep and dreaming, and the signatures of theta waves during inducement and gamma waves indicating the experience. The finding of gamma waves is most unexpected. The fact that these are general cerebral events, literally overspreading the brain, is most intriguing. 4 July, 1968. Rachel left.
When the truth is found to be
Rachel left. This was all that Edith wrote concerning that day. But as it happened that I was present, I can explain it more completely. There was so much of momentous significance that happened that day. I had been invited for the holiday celebration to her house. I should arrive about 4 in the afternoon, and there would be cocktails. I really loved her gin and tonics. And we would eat a barbecue, which the girls said they would do in her garden. And then, as it got dark, we would all walk to Grant Park and watch the fireworks from the promontory point over the lakefront. Approaching the house, I was surprised, and a bit shocked, I may say, to see a Viet Cong flag hanging from the middle second-story window above the front door, rather than the traditional Old Glory and its bunting. The door was wide open, and music was blaring out of it. In the living room, I found Rachel attempting a conscious raising, practiced on some dreamy hippie girls, nubiles, some hardly 14, I should think, whom she had rounded up from the Bixler play lot, where they had been smoking weed, I suppose. Being mostly stoned, I think they would go anywhere. Rachel, her voice like a megaphone, began as she always does with the reading from the Bible. The problem lay unspoken for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning. And, of course, per usual, she was playing Surrealistic Pillow loudly on the stereo at the same time, her anthem. Your eyes, I say your eyes may look like this, yeah, but in your head, baby, I'm afraid. You don't know where it is. You don't want somebody to love. You don't need somebody to love. Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love. The girls bobbled to the music. Or were they mesmerized by the incantations of feminism? Honestly, I don't know how Edith tolerates this woman, I thought to myself. But she relishes the wildest riches of life, she says. Where, you see, I prefer the steady scansion of a stately poem to be overwrought by the quiet ecstasy of glamorous rhetoric. I think I live in the wrong century. I should wear lacy ruffs and silk hose and silver garters. Edith was in the backyard with all her brood, who were standing over a smoking cauldron, looking at it in confusion and earnest attention. I should have said something to Edith about Rachel and all that, but she was so effusively glad to see me, so immediately generous with her gin and tonics and with her eager curiosity for my latest intellectual exploits, that I quite forgot what I had intended to say. Her garden was glorious, much more lush, well-watered and trimmed than it usually is, for it seems that, and here I shall follow Edith's convention of pseudonyms, if only because they amuse me, Mark Turtle and White Rabbit had souls of gardeners, and out of natural inclination and gratitude to Edith, they had given her garden a state of grace and beauty that it had never seen. It was like arriving to a museum, stepping from out of a noisy, dirty street into a gallery of lustrous oil paintings. I could not hear the music from this garden, or at least it was masked by the chatter of her girls and the activity they made at the barbecue, comings and goings to the house for accoutrements and snacks that they laid out for our picnic. And as I say, I am easily preoccupied with myself, and Edith has this charm upon me. We sat in her gazebo on lawn chairs, and she held my hands as I spoke fervently. When Howard came to the back door, Zoe, seeing him, ran to him and kissed him warmly on the mouth. Holding his face in her hands, he blushed, I think, and Edith called for him to join us. There must have been an interval in the music. I could not hear it from the house behind him. Howard complained. Edith, there is a Viet Cong flag hanging from your window. Edith stood up and moved away from me and said she did not understand. He explained then what I had seen. She said it must be Rachel's. The window was on their room on the second floor. Howard, I could see, was not blushing. He was enraged. He turned away from Zoe, though she tried to stop him, and went back into the house. Zoe, Edith, and I followed. The hippie girls had gone. Rachel was alone on the down sofa in the living room, watching television about the national celebration and commenting. The arm of the record player had lifted itself from the last track of Surrealistic Pillow, and she had not started it again. Howard confronted Rachel. "Why have you put a Viet Cong flag out the window? Who do you think you are? Did you ask Edith how she felt? This is her house." Rachel replied, still seated. Her eyes flashed. She felt no intimidation. She was enjoying this. She was hoping for this. "It's none of your business, you motherfucker." Edith almost spoke, but Howard spoke more quickly. "Yes, it is," said Howard. "I have enlisted. I have enlisted, and I will be fighting those who fly that flag. And I may die, or I will certainly see others who will die for our flag, not that one." I felt a numbing stun. Edith looked at Howard incredulously. Zoe looked at him sadly. Rachel looked at him with hatred. "Motherfucker, baby killer, murderer." Howard took her abuse for the impotent, spittle-tossed raging that it was, violent but nothing which touched him morally or physically. He glared at her as she spat her poisonous epithets of left-wing rhetoric and turned resolutely and went up the stairs. Rachel shouted after him, "Where are you going? What are you doing, you motherfucker? Don't you fucking dare!" She meant to follow him, but Zoe stood her way. She slapped Zoe's face. "Get out of my way, you fucking slut!" She chased Howard to her room, but she was too late. He had thrown open the window, and the flag had fallen to the front stoop. As he returned downstairs, she came behind him, striking his back with her fists, wanting to hurt him. But at the foot of the stairs, he stopped, turned, and when she raised her fist at him, he pushed her by her forehead away from him, and she fell backward onto her bottom, onto the stairs. She sat, breathing hard, and cursed him. She would call the cops. Howard said, "Please do. You do not live here. You are trespassing." She looked for once speechless, aghast. I said out loud what I was thinking. "It's about fucking time." Edith looked at me with shocked expression. I never curse crudely like that. But it seemed le mot juste. Zoe, unseen by all of us, had passed her fallen roommate on the stairs and had gone up to their room. We saw then clothes, underwear, books, sheaves of paper, toiletries, and a pillow being hurled from the upstairs window, falling upon the stoop to join the Viet Cong flag and strewn on Edith's front lawn. Rachel, seeing this, went out the front door and began randomly picking up items, her precious flag, and looked up at Zoe, who, leaning out the window, said, "Go away." Rachel replied succinctly, "Slut," and picking up only what she could carry, walked away from the house. She never came back for the rest of her clothes and books. Edith kept the books and gave the clothes to the Goodwill. The next time we saw Rachel, and the last time, would be on TV. Howard asked Edith, "Do you have an American flag?" Edith found it, furled on its staff, in her front door closet, and she herself posted it in the bracket beside her front door, installed for this purpose. We all gathered in the living room. The girls heard the altercation from the garden and had come inside, and watched from the end of the room behind us where the piano stood. All of us now stood in front of Howard, where Zoe had joined him to sit on the sofa clutching his arm, while he explained that he had enlisted because he could not see himself forsaking his country, even though he hated this war. that his grandmother had told him that he should not let victims die whom he could save, and so he decided he would enlist. He had enlisted in the Navy to be a corpsman. He smiled at Edith. "The good news is that this postpones my departure. We can complete our research. I do not report until September 30.
Your eyes, I say, your eyes may look like here.